Good morning. Well, it's a pleasure to be here today, and I'd like to thank the wonderful team of writers that helped put together this review paper that are listed here on the slide, and the wonderful team at NIOSH that organized this conference on occupational health disparities that was held last month. No financial relationships to disclose. There's no easily marketable device to reduce occupational health disparities. So. But as we know, the globalization of the economy over the past 30 years has profoundly changed the nature of work and the organization of work. These changes have increased job insecurity and other work organization hazards which can increase the risk of occupational injuries and illnesses and contribute to occupational health disparities or inequalities. In order to help us better understand these factors, we put together this model, looking at, for example, employment conditions, the extent of precarious or insecure work in an economy, and the extent of social protection, such as labor regulations or the proportion of the workforce that's unionized. And factors such as these then will influence organizational level factors such as downsizing, restructuring, outsourcing, privatization, the development of national and international contracting networks or supply chains which diffuse employer responsibility for occupational safety and health, the extent of temporary work, and so on. And these organizational practices influence job-level hazards, physical and chemical hazards, long work hours and shift work, psychosocial hazards such as high-demand, low-control work or job strain, lack of social support, and so forth. These relationships may be different in different industries. Now, how do these factors contribute to occupational health disparities? The main way that is shown in the research is that, as we would expect, groups with less power in the workplace, workers in lower socioeconomic positions, women, racial and ethnic minority workers, immigrants, and younger workers have greater exposure to these hazards. But in addition, there's some research that suggests that when exposed to these hazards, these groups with less power in the workplace also show greater health effects or differential vulnerability. Now, some people may say precarious work affects us all, and it does, but it seems to affect some people more than others. So in reviewing the research on this, we found that, yes, for the various groups we identified, in all cases, there was research indicating that they had greater exposure to job insecurity. There was also some research to suggest that lower-income workers showed a bigger health effect when exposed to job insecurity than higher-income workers. However, these areas shaded in red are areas where there's been very little research, less than 5 studies, so it's hard to make conclusions in those areas, and certainly more research needs to be done in those areas. What about other work organization hazards other than job insecurity? So again, we see for lower income workers, racial and ethnic minority workers, immigrants, and younger workers, greater exposure to work organization hazards. Women are exposed to some work organization hazards more than men. For other hazards, men more than women, so there's no overall pattern one way or another for gender. We also find that for lower-income workers, they seem to show a greater health effect when exposed to work organization hazards. And again, for certain these areas of research shaded in red, there are very few studies. Okay, so given this research, what can be done to reduce these hazards and reduce the injury and illness disparities that they cause? Strategies and programs have been tried in a variety of levels. Of course, at national and international levels, there are laws, regulations, and policies that are passed. For example, in England 7 years ago, their OSHA, enacted regulations requiring employers to identify work organization hazards and attempt to do something about them. And as a follow-up, they found an increase in the number of employer policies and procedures to deal with job stressors. No health assessment so far, but some information suggesting these are positive effects. We've also seen in some studies that countries with stronger social protection, such as in Scandinavia, show narrower social class and gender differences in low job control, a risk factor for illness. So less differential exposure by class and gender in these countries. And one recent study also showed a weaker association between job stressors and depression symptoms in Scandinavia compared to other European countries. Again, evidence for less differential vulnerability in countries with stronger social protections. Now, there's been very little research like that in the United States, but we have made attempts, at least at the state level, to address these issues. For example, state laws providing for safe staffing levels and bans on mandatory overtime for nurses in hospitals. And a recent California law that prohibits willful misclassification of employees as independent contractors, an attempt to bring more employees under labor protection. So all of these types of state laws really need to be better evaluated for their health and safety impacts. At company or organizational levels, collective bargaining is one strategy, although that's rarely been evaluated for its health and safety effects. More commonly studied are integrated occupational health promotion programs, which have shown benefits, health and safety benefits, both at the individual level and at organizational levels. For example, reducing rates of sickness absence in companies. Worker participation is an important feature of effective programs. Another example is the Maintenance Cooperation Trust Fund. This is a watchdog organization set up by the Service Employees Union and its signatory contractors, and their staff have gone examined retail chains that have contracted janitorial services which have failed to comply with labor laws and filed lawsuits and won back pay for workers in that industry. At the individual level, of course, there are wellness, stress management, health promotion programs which can benefit individuals, but the research indicates no real benefits seen at the organizational level for such programs. In addition, worker groups with less power, the ones talked about earlier, are less likely to participate in these kinds of prevention programs, less likely to be represented in labor management committees, less likely to complain about work hazards. So these prevention programs really need to focus on such workers. A program, for example, such as this one, which is a participatory research study of hotel workers in San Francisco. In our paper, which we hope you'll look at online, we also include some case studies of workers in various industries and how they have attempted to deal with health disparities in these industries. And finally, this review raised as many questions as perhaps we were able to answer, and we certainly welcome your advice and feedback on what can employers, workers, and unions do to minimize exposure to these hazards and to reduce differences between groups in exposure. What challenges stand in the way of laws and regulations designed to reduce exposure? What additional research is needed? For example, NIOSH has been doing national surveys of work organization hazards and other health and safety hazards, and is soon planning to provide on its website results from these national surveys. So that'll be a very important piece of evidence for us to look at. And finally, what kinds of research can be done that has a strong translational impact, that has a practical use in the workplace or developing policy? So thanks again, and we look forward to discussing these issues further with you. Thanks.